We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. On the 1st of January, 1863, in the midst of the American Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing, at least in theory, 3.5 million enslaved people in the Confederate States. On the 9th of April, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Ulysses S. Grant, formally ending the Civil War. However, not all enslaved people were in fact free at this point, especially in remote parts of the United States, such as in Texas. And not all enslaved people had been informed of their emancipation. But on the 19th of June, 1865, the Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, with 2,000 federal troops to enforce Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation and to free what they hoped were the remaining enslaved people in America. This date, June 19th, is now recognized as the celebration Juneteenth, which commemorates the true end of slavery for African Americans in the United States. So the Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, and that they are all endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights. But only after 90 years and a civil war were these rights finally extended to black people in the United States. Of course, many Americans celebrate the 4th of July as the date that marks their freedom and independence from the Empire of Great Britain. Many other Americans celebrate Juneteenth as the date that marks their freedom and independence from the institution of slavery. So our topic today is African American perspectives on the Declaration of Independence. How did African Americans, both free and enslaved, react to the Declaration? How did the Declaration change the calculus of black people, especially enslaved black people, especially since the British Army had already in 1775 offered freedom to those who joined their side? What was the experience of African Americans like during the War of Independence? What was it like to be a black loyalist? And what is the legacy of the Declaration for African Americans today? I'm delighted to have with me a special guest to answer all of these questions for you today, Professor Michael Dickinson. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
Dr. Dickinson is an associate professor of African American history at Virginia Commonwealth University. His research examines black life and labor in the 18th and 19th centuries in the United States and the Caribbean. He is the author of Almost Dead, Slavery and Social Rebirth in the Black Urban Atlantic, published in 2022, which was awarded the Paul E. Lovejoy Book Prize for Excellence and Originality in Slavery Scholarship. So, Michael, you began with that famous quotation from the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. Why did you choose to start with that most famous passage for our episode today?
So I chose that passage out of a number of other powerful quotations from the Declaration of Independence because it's such an important passage often cited by African Americans. People of African descent more broadly, as they were working to and demanding access to these natural rights that are communicated in the Declaration of Independence. They use these words oftentimes to highlight the importance of, and I think the hypocrisy of, the Declaration of Independence that guarantees freedom and guarantees equality for all men, highlighting that they have these natural rights endowed by their Creator, yet and still slavery existed and continued. And even for free people of African descent, they lacked the equality promised by the Declaration.
As you talk about this, I always think that it's critical to remember the huge variety of different types of experiences one could have as mm-hmm. a black person in the 13 colonies or indeed the Caribbean, and the French Caribbean and Saint-Domingue as well, mm-hmm. where there is maybe 120 some odd different categories of racial hierarchy. There were free blacks in the North, but there were slaves in the North, which we forget about. Mm-hmm. And all of these people had wildly different experiences with the institution. So how do you try to have your students sort of understand that black experience that you kind of just uttered while also remembering the huge variety of experience?
Well, I think a really useful way to try to wrap our heads around these vast array of experiences, as you rightly note, is to look at the lives of these people. Particularly those who have left a written record. It gives us some space and opportunity to imagine what that moment was like, what it was like to make very tough decisions, whether that means being free and trying to access equality, or whether that means being enslaved and trying to access freedom as well as equality. And so really wrapping our heads around that experience is essential, and I think the most powerful way to do that is to read the words of those who have been part and parcel to these revolutionary struggles in their own lives and trying to gain access to what the revolution promised.
Good. So maybe I'll just move on now just to talk about the release of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. Again, different black experiences, different people in the North and the South. How are different individuals, different black individuals in their different circumstances learning about the Declaration of Independence, and how are they responding to it?
Certainly. So I think what we need to highlight here to start off is that information spread during this period. And we live in the information age, so to speak, and we live in, you know, the technology age, and we tend to think about the spread of information swiftly moving, but we forget about is word of mouth carried ideas, thoughts, information through vast territories fairly swiftly, and that is not just limited to the founding fathers or propertied white men at the time. This is also connected to people of African descent, whether free or enslaved. They're hearing about the Declaration. They're hearing these words, life, liberty. They're hearing these natural rights discourse, whether that means that they're hearing it by serving these men, right, the founding fathers, many of them who are slaveholders, and or whether that means they're hearing it on the streets. They're hearing these things being communicated, and they're applying it to themselves, right? And so I think that's really important for us to highlight here. Now, that is not the intention of the founding fathers in many respects for the vast majority of them, but yet and still they see themselves within these words. Of course, we can talk about the fact that, you know, people of African descent are demanding freedom in their lives before this point. Whether we can see that through a number, you know, the numbers of runaways that are at a constant rate even before the revolution. But the discourses of natural rights, again, life, liberty, we can talk about independence and the like. Those words are not just words. These people of African descent, whether free or enslaved, these are things that they see themselves applying to their own lives. And so we can see, for example, for the enslaved population, is that there are upticks in runaways. In my book, actually, I have a chapter where I look at a runaway ad that's placed in the same year on July 4th, Declaration of Independence. How do we imagine what it means for this man to actually claim his freedom? His name was Caesar, claim his freedom at the same point when this monumental document is released. And so we have upticks and runaways. We have free people of African descent who are seeing this as moments where they can perhaps claim equality. They're sort of, some of them are sort of buying into this revolutionary further, as well as some enslaved folks. And we can see this in the life of, for example, of a James Fortin. He's a African-American man. He's a free black man, and he actually agrees to fight for the revolution, but all indication is that he actually was taken up in part by this revolutionary moment. I mean, we could talk about, for example, the first casualty of the revolution is a black man, right? Crispus Attucks. He's a mixed-race man. All indications are that he's of African descent, but likely also of Native American descent. And he's killed in the Boston Massacre, right? And so someone who actually gives his life for this revolutionary cause, I think symbolically and also literally, this speaks to the investment and the real connection in which people of African descent see the revolutionary moment and the revolutionary discourses within the Declaration and beyond as applying to their own lives.
Interesting. So it's never just so easy to say, as we look through lots of different aspects of the American War of Independence, it's very difficult to predict how any individual is going to react, mm-hmm. white, black, enslaved, or free, or anything, to anything that's happening. I'm reminded, of course, of the French Canadians who had been fighting English people for years and who had lost the Seven Years' War, and now they're under a British king, and then they're offered, okay, their independence along with the 13 colonies, but they don't join the fight. And you'd think, well, why don't they? Well, again, it's difficult to predict how anyone's mm-hmm. going to react here. So my question for you is, while it's difficult to predict, there are some reasons why then historians look and say, oh, French Canadians didn't join probably because of these reasons. But as you're looking at the variety of African-American experience, are there some telltale signs that would let you know that this is a reason that, for example, a black person, free or enslaved, would choose to actively support one side or the other? And of course, there's a third category of let's stay out of this conflict entirely.
Certainly. So I think a useful point is made by historian Benjamin Quarles, his anniversary of his, I think, iconic text, The Negro in the American Revolution, is swiftly approaching. And so he highlights, and I'm gonna quote this because I think it's worthwhile for us to really think about this. He says, insofar as he had freedom of choice, and he's talking about people of African descent, he was likely to join the side that made him the quickest and best offer in terms of those unalienable rights of which Mr. Jefferson had spoken. Whoever invoked the image of liberty, be he American or British, could count on a ready response from black people. And so what Quarles, I think, is really highlighting here, and this has stood the test of time, as you mentioned, is that people of African descent are really going to the side that gives them the best prospect of actually gaining those promises of the Declaration and of the revolutionary moment, right? So someone like James Forden, who I mentioned, he joins the revolutionary cause because he sees that as the most reasonable way for him to gain the equality that's promised in the Declaration, right? We see other people of African descent, particularly enslaved folks, who are going to British lines, right? And so there are about 5,000 to 8,000 enslaved individuals who actually fight for the revolutionary cause. About 20,000 to 30,000 fight for the British. And so what does that mean? That means that there is a calculus going on the part of these enslaved individuals about which side they think is going to win, which side is going to provide that freedom that should apply to them. And so they're having to make very tough decisions in real time. Part of that is not only, you know, knowing the British or the Patriot side, it's also circumstantial, right? And so we do see, for instance, in areas, we can talk about this in Philadelphia, for instance, right? When Philadelphia is occupied, there's a large number of enslaved folks that flee to the British because it makes sense, right? And so we can talk about this during the era of slavery more broadly. Running away was a calculated endeavor. These enslaved individuals are making very complex calculations about how do I maximize the success that I will actually gain freedom. And so that helps us to understand why they're choosing which side and why that matters in terms of their lived experience.
I understand that the most common form of resistance was simply escaping. Crispus Attucks left in the middle of the night and got on board a merchant vessel sailing away from Boston, and that's how he escaped slavery. During the war itself, you know, fleeing to the British lines after, say, Dunmore's proclamation would guarantee your freedom. But that's not the only form of or way that resistance can happen. And I think it's important we start thinking about some other forms of resistance that enslaved people might have chosen to undertake. So can you talk about those, please?
Sure. I think you're right that we think about, you know, running away. I mean, there have been historians that have quoted this as the largest slave revolt in American history, if we see this as this mass exodus of enslaved folks. But beyond that, I mean, the enslaved population's emboldened at this moment. You can see in newspaper accounts of enslaved individuals. You know, there's one in Philadelphia where a man is noted as accosting a quote-unquote gentlewoman in the street by calling her obscene names and saying, you know, just wait till Lord Dunmore arrives and with his Ethiopian regiment, right? And so it's not just the physical act of running away or fighting, it's also the emboldened, the sense, right, that they that there's a something, there's change in the air, so to speak. We also talk about the pen, right? I mean, during the Revolutionary era, we have a number of individuals, free Black individuals, who are writing, using and quoting the Declaration of Independence. James Fortin's one of them, who writes after the Revolution and actually quotes the Declaration of Independence. We can talk about Phyllis Wheatley, for instance, who's a poet in New England, and she very subtly she's asked to actually write a poem to try to encourage the Earl of Dartmouth to look favorably upon the Continental cause in the approach to the Revolution, and she subtly uses terms like independence and tyranny to highlight her own oppression, right, that she's stripped from her family in West Africa and taken to the Americas, to highlight this hypocrisy, right? And this is language being used to deliberately, you know, highlight the hypocrisy, the language that is being sort of shown as used as a mirror to the revolutionary cause. But during and after the Revolution, we could talk about, for instance, Oladipo Equiano, who writes the first really international slave narrative, and he uses the words of independence and tyranny and freedom deliberately to highlight the Declaration of Independence and cite it, but also highlight that in many ways Americans are not living up to the revolutionary ideals to which they purport, right? And so in many ways the Declaration of Independence in of itself and later on the Constitution provides the fodder for this press among African Americans or people of African descent more broadly to demand freedom and equality that ideally should be provided by these revolutionary documents and within these revolutionary documents.
Definitely. Really interesting. I want to maybe now focus a little bit on the experience after making that choice, so the experience of a Black man in the Continental Army, mm-hmm. serving in the Continental Army with white people and potentially some other Black people, and then the experience of that Black person who chose to join the British Army. What was his experience like there serving?
Certainly. What we can say is that whatever side, whether they chose the British or the Continental side, the experience is oftentimes fraught, keeping in mind that because there is not equality, there's a lack of security on the part of these soldiers. They're oftentimes given the assignments that white soldiers do not want. We can talk about, on the British side, Boston King, for instance, has a narrative where he talks about how he actually falls ill and the British Army just leaves him. And so he actually survives and experiences the rest of the war, but he's taken to Canada first and then to Sierra Leone. And part of his story and the story of these Black loyalists is that the British, although they do extract a number of them after the war, there's not a lot of planning that goes on in terms of their settlement, whether that's in Nova Scotia, for instance, whether that's later on Sierra Leone, whether that's in other parts of the British Empire, including the Caribbean. Many of these Black loyalists don't fare well, in large part because the British don't have a lot of care and in making plans so that they can actually survive. Even in Nova Scotia, for instance, there is some land given, but it's poor land in which they can't really cultivate or make a living. But on the other side of that, right, the British do have during the war some space for advancements for Black soldiers. We know that, for example, Thomas Peters, he becomes an officer in the British military. He's a Black man. And so that's not the case in the Revolutionary or the Continental Army, right? And so if we look at the Continental side, there is a large hesitance to even allow Black soldiers to fight for the Continental cause on the part, in large part on the part of George Washington. It's not until there's a point in 1776, when the Revolutionary Army, the Continental Army, is at an ebb. Their number of have died because of exposure and elements as well as through war. And that really switches the mind of the likes of Washington and the Continental cause to allow black soldiers to fight. So we can see that those who did fight, they aren't permitted the advancement. They are oftentimes given the jobs that white soldiers do not want. And I think most importantly, and this is something that is spoken by the life of a man named Jeffrey Brace, who I do a lot of work with his narrative. He's enslaved in Connecticut. He fights for the Continental cause and he fights valiantly. He's wounded. He gets a commendation for his service, but he goes back to his home with his slaveholder, and his slaveholder isn't trying to free him after the war. So there's this real juxtaposition with in the lives of these black soldiers on the part of the Continental Army that they aren't necessarily getting their freedom. Brace does get his freedom, but it's because there's this level of pressure on the part of the neighbors of his slaveholder, who very much are looking down upon him for not freeing Jeffrey Brace, despite the fact that he's many ways a hero, right? And so he does get his freedom, but it's circumstantial, not because of his service. And so what we can say is that the experience is fraught for these black soldiers, whether they are on the British side or the American side. And so very much it's based off of the circumstances, and Equiano will use the term providence, right? We can flip a coin about whether they would have success or not, because there's a very real chance, regardless of whether they fight for the British or the American side, that they won't get their freedom regardless. And so we need to really, I think about how difficult of a decision this is for these individuals. I've been speaking a lot about, you know, these black men, but also black women and children are also flocking to these camps, trying to gain their freedom, particularly these British camps. And so what does that mean to try to gain one's freedom, but having a large chance of being returned to your slaveholder at the end of the war?
Right. I want to get back to the black women and children experience.
Sure.
Just a quick question about Brace. So was he promised his freedom if he went to fight? And was he just like taking the place of his slaveholder?
He was taking the place of his slaveholder. He has the sense that he will get his freedom if he fights. There's no sort of mechanism to compel his slaveholder to actually free him afterward. And I think that's sort of the issue there, that his slaveholder isn't sort of forced to free him. And there's no one looking over his shoulder to make sure that Brace gets his freedom. But it's only because of this, again, this pressure by the peers, the neighbors, that he actually gives Brace his freedom.
And was this a common practice in the North and in the South that's, say, a slaveholder who... But there was no draft, was there? So, I mean, how would it work that you would send one of your enslaved people on your behalf?
Right. And part of that has to do, again, with sort of the circumstantial pressure, right? I mean, if particularly in New England, right, there's a lot of revolutionary fervor. And so the sense is that there should be some sort of contribution. And if I, the slaveholder, cannot go or do not have an ability or interest to go myself, I'm sending my enslaved person in my stead. And so that's very much, you're right, it's not something that's compelled, but something that's sort of, let's say, culturally expected in these revolutionary circles.
Well, you can see that there's sort of militias or regiments in the Continental Army, or groupings of soldiers in the army would react differently in different ways to mm-hmm. a one or more or even a unit of black people mm-hmm. serving beside them. You know, I would imagine that a Southern regiment mustered out of, say, the Carolinas would be less likely to want to fight beside a black Continental than in the North. But again, sometimes these assumptions don't hold true, do they?
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, to Brace's experience, he seems to have a favorable relationship with the white soldiers around him, but you're right that part of that is circumstantial, right? He's from a northern regiment, and so I think we need to compare that with some of the experiences of other units to really get a larger perspective.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, maybe we can take on this interesting theme of black women and children and the difficult choices they were faced with.
Yes. So what we can say is that, again, when we think about the war, we oftentimes think about these black men who serve as soldiers. But, I mean, in the camps, particularly the British camps, there are a large number of enslaved women and children. Now, this is not necessarily the intent of Lord Dunmore, for instance, when he issues this proclamation guaranteeing freedom for enslaved individuals who flee to British lines in Virginia. He's thinking about this Ethiopian regiment, this black regiment of soldiers. He's also trying to impact the decision among these colonists and trying to convince them to stop rebelling, right? Because their enslaved, quote-unquote, property is at risk. But what he gets is a mixed bag, right? There are black men that come to British lines, but there's also these enslaved women and children, not necessarily in the calculus of the British, but yet and still they're part of the camps, right? We can also talk about this in terms of the Continental Army, right? There are black women who are cooks or laundresses, right? They're doing cooking, cleaning, things that are sort of the everyday that help a camp run, right? And so that's important when we think about sort of the unseen labor of the revolution or any war for that matter. We don't have much in the way of written testimony from these women, but we know that their work is essential, as well as we talked about the service of black men, right? And so I think very much when we think about the war, we need to think about, particularly on the American side, that this war is successful, but it's not just the founding fathers. It's also, when we talk about the contributions of African Americans, as we should, we're talking about black soldiers, but also these black women who are essential to the war effort as well.
As you're describing all of these experiences, of course, the main idea that keeps hitting me square in the faces, none of these people have any good choices. It's bad choice or other bad choice. It's risk or another risk. And then I was thinking, you mentioned Crispus Attucks, and I didn't realize that he was probably half Native American too, but that's fascinating too. Do we know anything about the option of African Americans fleeing, say, west to, I guess, what we would call Indian country back then? And I know some traveled south to when Florida was part of the Spanish Empire. That was a route to freedom too. But what about west?
No, that's a really good question. So what we do know is that, you know, the estimates vary, but as many as 100,000 enslaved folks actually flee during the war. That's sort of the higher end of the estimate. But as we do the math, right, we see that, you know, 20 to 30,000 are fleeing to British lines, 5 to 8 are going to the Continental Army and actually fight for the Continental Army. And so, you know, the math isn't adding up there. So what happens to these other folks? Some of them, you're right, are fleeing to the west. Others are fleeing in spaces, you know, within the colonies that aren't necessarily in these British lines, and they're finding ways to hide and evade their slaveholders. And so there is that route to go to the west. But of course, then there's the reality of dealing with these native populations, right? Which, depending on the tribe, it can be a positive, or it can be something that will help them in gaining their freedom, or it might be that they might be returned or enslaved again, right? And so there's these range of experiences, once again, about, you know, where do they go? What is the chances of success in getting there? And there's also the role of sort of providence in this, right? That even if they do flee to British lines, or whether they flee to the west, whether they flee to these native populations, there's still a chance that they're going to be re-enslaved in one shape or form. And so you're right, there aren't necessarily great choices here. There are just choices, and they're trying to make the best of their circumstances to access freedom, despite not knowing, right? The unknown is perpetual during the war, but the war does provide, it provides the chaos in which to have greater options than they did have, right? And so I think that's important to think about as well.
And that's a really interesting point. War would make it easier to escape, absolutely, because everything is too chaotic. So in that respect,
certainly,
war could have been a good thing. I want to turn back to the Declaration of Independence and something that I still can't quite grasp. And this is the famous deleted passage that Thomas Jefferson wrote, saying how terrible it was that King George still supported the slave trade. And we know that wasn't included in the final draft of the Declaration of Independence. Can you just explain the distinction that people had the economic or moral or ethical or whatever distinction it was, that the slave trade itself was bad, but continuing to enslave people over generations was okay. Because it's just something I don't understand.
Right. I mean, so when we think about the passage that Jefferson includes, right, it looks negatively upon the slave trade, as you mentioned, and it's very much pointing fingers at the British as sort of imposing this immoral traffic in human beings on the colonies. And the fascinating thing is, at the same time, the British are framing this as an American phenomenon, right? Saying that, you know, that the colonies, ironically, they're talking about liberty and equality and the like, and yet still they're very much engaged in this Atlantic slave trade, right? And so when we do see that the abolitionist movement, it emerges on both sides of the Atlantic, but it has sort of more energy and traction on the British side, right? And they're at the forefront of ending the slave trade after the Revolution. And so what we can say is that when this abolitionist movement gains traction, the likes of Equiano are essential to that. A lot of Equiano in his narrative, and a number of slave narratives, as well as the efforts of Granville Sharp and the like. But it's important for us to highlight that much of their evidence is very much based off of the Atlantic slave trade, highlighting the evils of the slave ship, for instance, and what does the death look like? What does the human suffering look like, right? And so that tends to be the central sort of sticking point. Now, Equiano will highlight the evils of slavery more broadly, but there's a sense to which the Atlantic slave trade provides I don't want to say easier target, but a clearer target for the abolitionist movement very early. And this is especially true because in the colonies themselves, once we get into the late 18th, 19th century, they have a self-replicating slave population, right? And so the Atlantic slave trade doesn't necessarily hit the wallets of slaveholders in America in the way that it would in the Caribbean, for instance, where Jamaica, for example, is very reliant on the Atlantic slave trade, right? So slaveholders there are very much connected to the Atlantic slave trade, are bothered once the British government decides to abolish it. And so there's this very real disconnect between the institution of slavery and the slave trade as an issue in the minds of slaveholders, but I think governments on both sides of the Atlantic. What we will see is that it's a heavy lift to abolish slavery, of course, the slave trade, of course, but it's an even starker, more complex fight in the United States, as well as in Britain, to and the institution of slavery. And we can see it takes decades until that actually happens for the British in the 1830s. And of course, the United States takes a war to end slavery in the 1860s.
So the distinction was not really one of the morality of slavery itself. It was just the journey over was bad, or worse than being a slave working on a plantation. I mean, I guess I still don't understand what
right. No.
Bizarre. But clearly, he wouldn't have wrote this. This distinction was like, I guess, do we call this nowadays, what do we call it? A permission structure, right? So it's kind of creating a permission structure to be like kind of half acknowledge that there's something wrong going on, but you can blame something else instead. So you're fine where you are because there's something worse that you can blame it on. I don't know. Maybe it's just a weird human psychology thing.
Right. I mean, I think two things just to summarize are going on here. You know, the British and the Americans are pointing fingers at themselves, sort of blaming each other for the Atlantic slave trade and sort of trying to get the moral high ground. The other thing is, I mean, there is sort of a distinction, you know, a cognitive dissonance on the part of someone like Jefferson, right, who highlights that the Atlantic slave trade, he's admitting that it has evils, right, extraordinary brutality and the like. But you're right that that same thing can be true said for the actual, you know, day-to-day of slavery itself. Of course, the difference in the minds of many of the slaveholder is that they would say, you know, given the justification for slavery at the time, that slavery is a quote-unquote natural good in many ways, that it's the sort of the natural order of things, that people of African descent require this level of control over their lives, that they are most productive, right, when they have this. And there's also increasing, once we get into the 19th century, you can talk about this scientific racism, this hierarchy of the races, that there is this quote-unquote natural place of oppression in which people of African descent should find themselves, right? And so the institution of slavery is something that's justified in ways that the Atlantic slave trade is not. And I think this has to do again with the profit motive, right? Atlantic slavery isn't as necessary by the time we get to this point in history in the United States because of this naturally increasing slave population, right? And so it allows for that cognitive disconnect.
Slightly clear, still confusing, but I don't think there's any way we can square these distinctions. Okay, I'm curious now if we can go to, you mentioned that, which I had never heard before you said this earlier, that Black loyalists were sent potentially to Sierra Leone, which mm-hmm. I didn't realize. I knew some wound up in Nova Scotia. So what is the experience of the Black loyalist like towards the end of the war, as they can tell, okay, you know, we got to leave these new United States. The United States is going to prevail. What do we do? Where do we go? So can you talk about some of their experiences, please?
Certainly. I mean, I think in a word, chaos. I'm actually working with the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia in the States, who is putting together an exhibit on loyalists, and Black loyalists are part of that exhibit. And we're trying to really push forward and try and help, you know, audiences understand is that this is a moment of chaos, right? For white loyalists, certainly, but also Black loyalists, they don't know what's going to happen next, right? They know the British promised that they would have freedom, but they did not also anticipate that the British would lose the war, right? And so they're trying to figure out exactly what to do next in order to gain said freedom. And so we have these major ports in Charleston and New York, for instance, where ports of extraction. We also need to highlight that the British and the American leaders don't necessarily know what's going to happen either, right? They're trying to figure that out and work it out. The American colonists, especially Washington, are trying to demand that the British return all the enslaved runaways back to their colonial masters. But on the British side, there's a reticence to do that, in part because they did provide this promise, and there's a sense in which that these people of African descent, that they are British subjects who fought for the crown during the war, and so there should be some effort to fulfill that promise. Now, what that looks like, of course, is that some of these enslaved individuals who a fraction are actually taken away by the British. There's still a number who are taken up by their slaveholders. So again, the chaos, right? We have slaveholders that are grabbing folks, grabbing their enslaved individuals, finding them, grabbing them, taking them back forcibly. We have the British that are trying to make sure that they're not being forcibly taken. We have ships leaving in chaotic fashion as people are trying to leave. We have the British trying to tabulate who these enslaved folks are. There's a document called the Book of Negroes where they work to do that, particularly in New York, to try to highlight, you know, who these folks were, who their slaveholders was, et cetera, et cetera. And so many of them are taken, as you mentioned, to Canada, especially Nova Scotia. The problem there is that, again, there is not reasonable provisions provided for these Black loyalists. And so there's an effort on the part of a Thomas Peters, for instance, who was made a British officer during the war, a Black man. He's part of this effort to petition the British government for land, petition the British government for help, because there's a lot of suffering on the part of these Black refugees. And the British government decides to take this population if they're willing to go to a British colony of Sierra Leone in Africa. And of course, something similar happens in that the British don't really think the logistics through particularly well. And so, A, there's already a population there that are living there, so there's conflicts there. But there's also, in terms of provisions, not enough to secure this population, so there's still poverty, sickness. Boston King, for instance, who I mentioned actually fought for the British crown, he's an enslaved man from the South. He gets married during the war. His wife comes with him. They go to Canada. He's taken to Sierra Leone. His wife dies shortly after from an illness. And so that really speaks to sort of this, it's not only poverty, it's also death because of disease, exposure, and the like that happens on the part of these British loyalists. And I think the larger point is that it's not a fairy tale for most of these individuals, whether they fight or they join the British side or the American side. They have these very real struggles, whether they get their freedom or not, because of a lack of equality and a lack of support that should have been provided.
So being a Black loyalist after the war did not necessarily mean that you were going to have some sort of happy existence. And indeed, being a African-American in the United States, slave or free, came with its own challenges. And that makes me think of the introduction, which I started today, talking about Juneteenth, where, of course, black people, it took 90-some-odd years after the Declaration of Independence for many enslaved people to be freed. So, obviously, black people have a different attitude towards the 4th of July than potentially others. So how would you interpret this story?
I would say it's complex on the part of people of African descent, whether enslaved or free. There's the complexity of very much believing in what the Declaration of Independence stood for. The ideas of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, they ring true to the desires of people of African descent, and this is something that they want to claim and think that should apply to themselves, and so in so much that some of them voluntarily fight for the revolutionary cause, and so they are certainly part and parcel to this American project, this newly formed nation. This will be true for all of the major wars. I think a good argument could be made that at least in part the revolution, the war is won because of this black participation. And so they're at the heart of this American project from its very inception. And so there's a desire to claim that. And so we can think about this duality between David Walker, for instance. He's an abolitionist in the 19th century. He famously writes his fiery appeal to the colored citizens of the world. And he actually quotes the Declaration of Independence in 1829. And he says, you know, look to your declaration, Americans. And he makes the argument that people of African descent have every right to claim the promises of America because they were essential from its inception, that their blood, sweat, and tears have gone into this nation, and they should not be seen as other or disregarded in terms of equality or liberty. He's particularly talking about the growing idea of trying to relocate free black individuals to colonies in Africa in order to sort of get them out of the country. And he's saying, we have claim to this nation as well. I mean, the other side of that, we think about a Frederick Douglass, a famous abolitionist. He provides his famous speech, you know, what to the slave is the 4th of July in the 1850s. And his argument is that the celebration of the Declaration, the celebration of freedom, the celebration of liberty, these are wonderful ideals, but in the minds of people who are enslaved, it's hypocrisy, right? And so there's a duality of laying claim to this American project, but this frustration that there is this real hypocrisy, a failure of the United States to live up to these revolutionary ideals in the experiences of black people.
I think a lot about the fact that a lot of these dates that any nation chooses to celebrate are, you know, artificial in many different ways. I mean, I think on the third of July would just be just as good as the 4th, because I think the final text might have been approved on the 3rd, but not voted on until the 4th, so whatever. But then, you know, I had mentioned in my introduction Juneteenth. Did that really mark the end of slavery? Well, no. I mean, I'm sure there were pockets and corners of the South where slavery, in fact, existed. And of course, the Civil Rights Act wasn't passed for another 100 years or so. So like, what even does Juneteenth celebrate? We could potentially have another holiday for, I don't know, the Civil Rights Act passing. But the point I'm trying to make is, certainly with the African-American experience, it's hard to just say when things finally were better or equal, including to today, you know?
Right.
So I mean, how it's hard to commemorate anything.
Right. I mean, I think what you're getting at, and I think importantly so, is the tension, right? This tension between how black Americans see themselves, right? They see themselves as inheritors and part and parcel to the American experience and American history more broadly, but faced with the reality that the United States has not lived up to those ideals. And oftentimes, when we think about narratives of the American Revolution, for instance, or I think we can make the argument about large developments of American history more broadly, African Americans are left out. And that's not true to the reality of the experience yet, and still that they're not part of the narrative. And so the tension there is Black Americans seeing themselves as part of this American experience and American history, but the narratives leave out that important contributions that their ancestors have made. And so how to celebrate freedom and those ideals, right, equality and the like, in a space and place that is not provided in traditionally in a 4th of July. And so I think that makes a day like Juneteenth all the more important, that this is a holiday that provides a space for that in ways that traditionally has not been provided by mainstream 4th of July celebrations. I think we can make the same argument. I mean, there's also talk around the Black national anthem versus the traditional national anthem, right? And the idea is the same, right? That there is this important claim to America, American history by Black people that isn't necessarily recognized in mainstream narratives. And so where is the space for that? Well, we'll create our own, right? We'll create a Juneteenth, we'll create a Black national anthem in order to square that hole and deal with that tension.
Really interesting. We're coming to the end of our conversation today, Professor Dickinson. And I asked all my guests to reflect then on the 250-year anniversary, this complicated 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So what are your final thoughts as you think about this anniversary?
So as we reflect on this anniversary, I think it's a time for us to take a step back and look at ourselves as a nation, as Americans, and really look at how we are living up to the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, and also how we aren't. I think this is a moment of potential celebration, but also potential introspection, right? Because I think part of the American project is understanding that it is a project, that it is something that will require work, that requires analysis, reflection. It requires effort to constantly realize the ideals of the American Revolution, which are ideals, right? That they are something to ascribe to, something to reach for, but something that requires constant effort to try to reach. And so we can think about that in terms of American history, but I think in particular when we think about the experiences of Black Americans, we should think about the ways in which we are living up to those ideals, we are trying to live up to the ideals, and the ways that we've fallen short, and how we can do better moving forward so for the next anniversary we can think about the progress that was made.
Professor Michael Dickinson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.